Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Just under 2 months ago, Politico reported on a draft majority opinion by the Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade after 50 years. It was an unprecedented leak of a court opinion, and it left most people convinced that the final ruling, when it came, would make access to abortion a state-by-state decision rather than a constitutional right. And yet, when the decision came Friday morning, the ruling still sent shockwaves across the country and the world. Wiping away Roe and Planned Parenthood v. Casey, the 1992 decision that seemed to have cemented Roe v. Wade, marks the first step in what is sure to be a long, winding, and highly contentious road to determine abortion policy in 50 separate states. Already, so-called trigger laws, going into effect with Roe struck down, have or will soon prohibit abortion in 13 states. Various forecasts anticipate more than half the states, including South Carolina, will ban access to abortion, often without exceptions for rape or incest, which begs the question locally, what will happen in North and South Carolina? What are the likely political battles ahead? In early May, when Politico's bombshell dropped, three experts came on this program to help sift through the many questions raised by the draft opinion. We have, on short notice, summoned them again, this time to help us better understand where things might go from here now that Roe v. Wade has been overturned. With us today are Rebecca Kreitzer. She is Associate Professor of Public Policy at UNC Chapel Hill and a close follower of the abortion debate. Good morning to you.
Morning.
Also joining us is Seema Iyer, who is the Chief Legal Correspondent at Queen City News and who was on this very program on Friday, which ended 10 minutes before the court's ruling was announced. So welcome back to you, Seema.
Good morning, everybody.
And also returning is Julie Rovner. She is Chief Washington Correspondent for Kaiser Health News and host of KHN's weekly policy podcast, What the Health. Good morning.
Good morning.
If you have comments or questions, share them by email at charlottetalks@wfae.org or on Twitter at Charlotte Talks. We are also on Facebook Live. You know, in a way, listening to the reactions after the ruling, I can't even speak, in a way, listening to the reactions after the ruling sounds more like a shift in the decades-long battle, not the end of a policy war. Here is Tammy Fitzgerald, Executive Director of the North Carolina Values Coalition.
This is a huge victory for unborn babies and their mothers. And lives are already being saved.
And this is North Carolina Congresswoman Alma Adams.
I'm angry as hell today because this decision is fundamentally wrong. This decision will affect everyone, but the impact will fall hardest on those who already face barriers to care. Black and brown women, those who live in rural areas or have lower incomes and can't afford to cross state lines for care, young people and the LGBTQ people, and women in abusive relationships.
Rebecca, let's start with what this means for North Carolina. What is the immediate impact of the Dobbs decision?
Well, here in North Carolina, we have a couple of laws that predate or that are up for debate about whether or not they go into effect. So we had a pre-Roe law from 1972, but the law that that Republicans in the NCGA have said we should go back to and go back into effect is a 2015 law that has been enjoined. That means that it hasn't been enforceable previously. And what that law would do would be limit the gestational age at which point you can get an abortion in North Carolina to 20 weeks. Before, it was viability, which was the standard set by Casey in the Supreme Court in 1992. People might be wondering, what's the difference between viability, which often happens at 24 weeks, though it's important to note that viability actually depends on the individual pregnancy, and it's not like a light switch that flips on or off. And so some people might be thinking, there's not a huge difference between 20 weeks and 24-ish weeks, but really you should think about that in terms of it's an entire month of time that people can raise money, figure out the logistics, schedule appointments, and decide what they want to do with their lives. And so in the absence or as a result of Roe, we're going back to that 2015 law.
And Seema, as I mentioned in the introduction, it seems to be a foregone conclusion that South Carolina will severely restrict access or perhaps prohibit it altogether. What might be some of the impacts on Charlotte and North Carolina in terms of the strain and the additional demand that that would create?
Oh, yeah, exactly. I think because so South Carolina has this pending heartbeat bill where the line is 6 weeks, and it was sitting in limbo, but now McMaster said on Friday he's going forward with it. And so I think we can expect an influx of people from South Carolina into North Carolina trying to get abortions. And that would clearly put a strain on the doctors and clinics here in North Carolina. But I think other states are gonna suffer the same, other states around this country where they are going to be able to house women who need abortions.
Julie, much of the South, as you know, is anti-abortion. In terms of, you know, the legislatures that are setting policies, what are you watching closest in the Carolinas and across the South?
Well, obviously, North Carolina is also going to be, you know, the stopping point for women from Kentucky on Tennessee also, where it's going to be difficult already. Abortion's already banned in Kentucky. So this is going to be a, you know, big question. I think the other really big question is what happens to the abortion pill? You know, everybody says we're going back to the world pre-Roe. We're really not, because we have a very different world than we did in 1973. And one of the ways that it's different is that women can terminate early pregnancies by taking a series of pills. And states, obviously, anti-abortion states know that and will try to make it as difficult as possible. And the federal government, at least currently, is going to try to make it easier. And I think that's going to be a very large tension point going forward.
Well, and that I was going to get to that later. Let's get to it now because it's very interesting. One of the things that I read over the weekend, I did not realize this, that about half of all abortions are now
more than half
with this the pill, medicated pill. Seema, I was going to ask you, to Julie's point, when we start getting into trying to govern people's mail and what they can and can't receive, you know, how, I guess, how much of a thicket are we about to wade into in terms of, you have the federal government controls the Postal Service, as we all know, but then there's the issue of states controlling healthcare. So what do you expect to see in this realm?
Okay, so number one, the FDA, you know, has some say in this because they approve whether these pills can be taken or not. Then when you have like the federal government always trumps the states when it comes to the law, right? However, in my opinion, I think there's going to be a tremendous amount of lawsuits because I think the states that are banning abortion are going to try to ban these medications as well, because it falls under the state. So they're going to say, listen, Supreme Court said that it's up to the states to regulate abortion. So it's not about the mail. The mail isn't the substance of the legal argument. The legal argument is the abortion. And I think there's just, the states are going to try to end those as well. Rebecca?
I absolutely agree with Seema. And just to add a point of clarification, is we're talking about medication abortion, which can be safely taken up until about the 12th gestational week of pregnancy. And there's already been a plethora of lawsuits that have restricted access to medication abortion. So a few more fun facts for you to know. Medication abortion has been around for a long time. It's freely available and over-the-counter in other countries. Even developing countries like Nepal have easy access to medication abortion. So here in the U.S., there's been a debate about medication abortion for many years, namely around what's called telemedicine abortion. And telemedicine abortion became much more common during the pandemic. But what it did is it allowed people in rural areas to speak with a provider over like a Zoom-like interface before getting prescribed the medication. Today, what we're seeing is that there's been an increase in providers that are working to mail pills across state lines, which is a little bit different than what's been done in the past. So we have a couple of things at play here. We have states that are actively trying to restrict medication abortion writ large within their states. We have some states that are trying to limit whether or not you can use telemedicine abortion. And then most recently, we have states that are trying to say you can't even receive mail that has pills in it.
And I think it's really important to point out that you get the abortion pill in a much different way than you get almost any other prescription, that the FDA has these very strict protocols for how it can be dispensed. A doctor can't just call the pharmacy, call in a prescription. Doctor can't just hand you a prescription. Most pharmacies can't even dispense this. It has to come from providers who are specially licensed to do it. And that's why these telemedicine contacts have been so important, because it's not just available at your local pharmacy.
And to Julie's point about it and not just being local, necessarily available at your local pharmacy, is that these same medications are sometimes used when you have an incomplete miscarriage. So that means that you've had a miscarriage, but not all of the contents of the uterus have been expunged. And so if those aren't all released from the body, they can cause fatal sepsis. And so providers often prescribe these medications for you to pick up. But in recent years, we've seen an increase in the number of pharmacists who have been denying these medications to people, not for the purpose of abortion, but denying people really life-saving medication as a result of miscarriage.
That's the voice of Rebecca Kreitzer. She's an associate professor at UNC Chapel Hill. Also with us today is Julie Rovner from Kaiser Health News and Seema Iyer from Queen City News. I'm bouncing around a little bit because there's so many tentacles to this, but I want to ask you, Rebecca, you know, when we think about North Carolina, as you said, access remains in large part because it has divided state government and because Republicans lack the supermajorities to overturn Governor Roy Cooper's expected veto if they moved on this. Republicans need 3 seats, I believe, in the House, 2 in the Senate to be able to overturn gubernatorial veto. So do you think this intensity that we're hearing and seeing right now, will that carry over to November?
I think absolutely. Traditionally, there's been what I call an asymmetrical mobilization on the issue of abortion. By that, I mean that conservatives have been more mobilized, more likely to turn out to the polls as a result of the issue of abortion. But many Democrats, while they might have cared about the issue, they didn't really think that it was at stake. They didn't really think that they needed to turn out to vote on this particular issue. And that's all changed now. And so while there's been a very asymmetric mobilization that has benefited turnout among conservatives looking to restrict access to abortion, that all might flip now as a result of the Supreme Court decision. And as you say, here in North Carolina, the access to abortion is quite precarious. We have not only the balance of the NCGA, which, as you said, is within reaching point of a veto-proof supermajority, but we also have a state Supreme Court election that also could shape things, which is to say that currently there are 2 seats up for election in the state Supreme Court. And right now the balance is 4-3 Democrats, and 2 of the Democratic currently held by Democrat seats are up for re-election. And then in the subsequent election, of course, Democratic Governor Roy Cooper is up for re-election. So there's actually a lot of different political actors and a lot of elections that are coming up, all of which could have a big impact on access in North Carolina.
And you mentioned Roy Cooper obviously will be at the end of his second term in 2024. He is term limited. And Josh Stein, the attorney general, is one of the likely candidates on the Democratic side. And he has already come out pretty forthrightly in terms of this decision, correct?
That's correct. But it's worth saying, this is a little bit off topic, but actually just earlier in the week, last week, there was another Supreme Court case that came out that affects North Carolina. In that case, it had to do with gerrymandering and redistricting in the state and whether or not Josh Stein could be the person to challenge this issue.
That's right.
And the Republicans in the NCGA brought this case to the Supreme Court. And basically their argument was, well, we don't think that Attorney General Josh Stein is challenging this rigorously enough in the way that we would want it to be challenged. And the Supreme Court kind of ruled that the Republicans could take on challenging the issue.
Hold that thought, Seema. We're going to take a quick break. Stay with us. A lot more to come here on Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. We are continuing our discussion of Roe v. Wade being overturned and some of the ways that is likely to affect people here in North and South Carolina. Our panel of experts are here to help sort out the many decisions and debates ahead. They are Julie Rovner from Kaiser Health News, Seema Iyer from Queen City News, and UNC Chapel Hill Associate Professor Rebecca Kreitzer. And Seema, I think you had something to say when we went to break.
Oh, well, I was just going to add what Rebecca was talking about, the Supreme Court redistricting case regarding North Carolina. I'm not as worried about that only because it was ruled simply on procedural grounds, the federal rules of civil procedure, which is why it was an 8-1 decision. But to Rebecca's point, absolutely that Berger et al., you know, aren't going to be represented by Josh Stein appropriately. So they want to intervene on that lawsuit. So it's clearly a factor.
And Seema, let's continue putting your legal background to good use here. So much has been made of Justice Clarence Thomas's concurring opinion released Friday, in which he wrote that the court should reconsider and overturn historic decisions that legalize contraception, same-sex intimacy, and same-sex marriage. How likely do you think that may be?
Okay, I just want to point out how he did not mention interracial marriage, right? Okay, great. Because if people don't know, his wife is white. I think it's likely, I think it's likely that this is a concern. This is a concern, absolutely. I don't know how likely it is that that would actually happen, because I think, you know, Justice Kavanaugh isn't necessarily on board with that. And in the majority opinion, Alito says, okay, don't worry about the other rights. However, and I'm looking at, and on page 31, he goes into this saying that the right to an abortion does not have a sound basis in precedent. And then he refers to Casey and he says, Casey relied on cases such as Loving versus Virginia, the interracial marriage case, Griswold versus Connecticut, the contraception case. And then he goes on to refer to post-Casey decisions that were mentioned in the briefs, in the supporting briefs. And in those cases, the one that is referred to is Obergefell, which is a same-sex marriage. So if you're going to say that Casey has a flimsy reliance on certain cases, then those cases that you're relying on, or that you rely on, you know, afterwards in this argument, I think they're all in danger.
For Julie and Rebecca, I want to ask you on the policy side. I was thinking about this over the weekend, and people are pointing it out and writing about it, but the unbelievable acceleration in terms of the change in policy for abortion. So let's walk through this real quickly. In 2006, Democrats won control of both sides of both houses of Congress. 2008, Barack Obama is elected president. 2016, Justice Antonin Scalia, one of the most conservative justices on the court, dies months before a presidential election. Barack Obama then nominates Merrick Garland, and Hillary Clinton is the overwhelming favorite to be the next president. So at this point, it looks as though a liberal majority is about to go to the court. And certainly for people who are thinking about Roe v. Wade, it is cemented. And we know what happens next, which is that Senator Mitch McConnell blocks Merrick Garland, Hillary Clinton loses, and then Donald Trump, as president, ends up nominating successfully three of the five justices who overturned Roe last week. Are people's heads spinning on both sides of this when you look at it from that viewpoint?
You know, yes and no. I mean, this has been coming kind of inexorably for years, for decades. I've been covering abortion since the late 1980s, and you could see how they were laying the groundwork for this, that the Republicans had made the courts in particular, and the courts in general, and the Supreme Court in particular, their number one priority in a way that Democrats never did. And when Democrats would say, oh, Roe v. Wade is on the ballot, Democrats would say, no, not really, we don't see it. So I think this has really been an amazing and very long game by anti-abortion activists to get to this point. But for those of us who are paying close attention, not all that surprising.
I agree with that. You know, as somebody who's been watching this closely for many years, this is not at all surprising. One thing that I think is an important takeaway from this is that throughout our whole entire history, the Supreme Court has actually been a very partisan and very political institution, going back truly to the early days of American government. And a lot of Americans today like to think of the judiciary as being this impartial arbiter of justice. And we don't like to think of the courts as being very political and partisan. But I think that this has been revealing to the mass public in a way that many people are starting to see that. What we've seen in this case is that Democrats for a long time, as Julie was saying, asymmetric mobilization, they didn't really think that Roe was going to be overturned because they thought that the institution of the court would save and protect the fundamental right to abortion. And as a result, it just wasn't a priority. We saw over the last 20 to 30 years, substantial changes in the anti-abortion rights strategic movements. So we saw after Roe and especially after Casey, that the anti-abortion rights movement realized that it was unlikely that they would be able to overturn Roe completely. And so they kind of stopped trying. Instead, they passed a plethora of laws that would slowly chip away incrementally, but as a whole, as a cumulative effect, quite substantially, the right to abortion. But what we've seen recently is that their strategy has changed because, as they themselves explain, who is on the court has changed. So now that the members of the Supreme Court have changed, they no longer need to try for an incremental approach in order to withstand judicial scrutiny. Now they can go for the big changes that they've been laying the groundwork for decades.
That's the voice of Rebecca Kreitzer. She's an associate professor at UNC Chapel Hill. Also with us is Julie Robner. She is with Kaiser Health News, and Seema Iyer from Queen City News. To that point, Seema, this was something that I wondered about as I was preparing for the show over the weekend, which is a lot of the political conversation has immediately shifted to on the Republican side, obviously, let's not only preserve this, let's go farther and really, you know, take out abortion state by state. On the Democratic side, it immediately turned to go out and vote so that we can win or maintain the House, maintain the Senate, and codify the right to access to abortion. And here's my question for you. It's a little bit of a hypothetical, but if that happened, not many people expect the Democrats to sweep. Obviously, it's looking like a strong Republican year, although the decision Friday throws everything up in the air. However, if the Democrats were able to do that, what I was wondering is, do you then go back down the path of litigating this again and taking it back to the Supreme Court? In other words, does this open up Marbury
versus
Madison?
That's a great question. That is a great question. So I think number one, the strongest way forward to make abortion legal is obviously Congress, right? For it to be the law of the land. However, I can foresee a lot of lawsuits because people on whatever side you are want to be grandfathered in or grandfathered out of whatever that time period when the law goes into effect. So that is clearly an issue. And I just want to say one thing in addition to what Rebecca was saying earlier, was that, this is why the dissent in this opinion was so powerful, because it was like three people joined together in the dissent talking about the legitimacy of the court being so at risk, that people just, getting on this court for their political motivations. And then, of course, the other part that was also, I think, really powerful in the dissent was, does stare decisis or precedent even matter anymore after something like this? Because, and one more thing, Casey was very split. Okay, so when it came to Casey, they were split three ways, the justices. But at the end of the day, Casey affirmed Roe because of precedent. And that was so much, that was like 19 years, right? 19 years of precedent. So for just the fact that Roe has been around for 50 years, you would think that was strong enough for everyone to be convinced to uphold at least that, or at least go with what Roberts said is, okay, we'll just make it 15 weeks or, Dobbs versus Jackson. Yeah.
much more of that incremental approach that Rebecca was referring to. I want to share a couple of responses from our audience. Judy on Facebook says, choice taken away from women. There is no other way to cloak this decision. Walter emails and he says, pro-life proponents all seem informed by a belief in the sanctity of life created by a supreme being, God. Belief in God is certainly an aspect of religion. How does this jibe with our country's policy of separation of church and state? I don't know if anyone wants to respond, but if you do.
Well, I just want to say that there has been a lot of talk about this over the weekend. That is this really, like, not enough people are talking about the religion issue, but that really may be the issue, because then you take viability, gestational period, all of that out of the equation. If you think that moment is come from God. Rebecca was nodding. Yeah.
Yeah. I would just add to that, you know, just to be clear, because maybe not everybody knows this, is that different religious traditions have different views about abortion. And in fact, for example, Jewish people believe that there are certain points and times in which you have to have an abortion if your life is at stake and you have other children that are going to be affected by it. I've also seen people referring to this as like Sharia law. And that's a very problematic phrase, because actually in Muslim countries like Saudi Arabia, access to abortion is more liberal than it is in the US. And so this is really policy that's driven by Christian beliefs about when life begins. And there's a lot of questions about whether or not this is the imposition of Christian beliefs on the rest of the population. And I think that will be a key theme in challenges to this new status quo.
And there's already a synagogue in Florida that is suing over the state's law, over the state's ban, saying that this is a violation of their religious freedom as Jews, because this is not what Jewish tradition requires.
And I just have to add in there that this current Supreme Court has seen a lot of cases that have to do with religion in the last few years and religious beliefs. And as someone who just pointed out the political nature of the Supreme Court, we certainly have seen some inconsistencies in how this Supreme Court has dealt with religion. For example, if you look at cases that have to do with the death penalty, the court has been, I'll just say it, inconsistent in whether and when they allow prisoners to have rights to their religious leaders. And that often tracks alongside what the prisoners' religious beliefs are. We also saw a Supreme Court case last week, that had to do with funding of religious schools and whether or not they should be able to get public money in order to do that. So this current Supreme Court has shown an inclination to change the relationship between church and state that has been traditionally separated since early America.
Rebecca, you mentioned earlier you were talking about not only differences in religious beliefs, but in other parts of the world. And I have a question a little bit related to that, which is we often hear the question asked, quite reasonably, in my opinion, why are men setting policy on women's health issues and what women choose to do or not do with their bodies? But I'd like to ask the question in a slightly different way. Are abortion policies in the rest of the world similarly written and determined by men the way they are here in the United States?
Yeah, oh, I love that question, actually. I haven't been asked that. My answer is going to be yes, in large part because policy around the world, if you look at governments around the world, are really dominated by men. And so absolutely, to the degree that most policy around the world is shaped by men, it also means that the abortion policy in other parts of the world is also shaped by men. That isn't to say that women haven't had a leading role in shaping policy, even when they're not the majority. And so we've seen across the world, both women policymakers, but also women in the mass public leading social movements to try to shape and change the status quo. So a good example of that is about 10 years ago, there was a death of an Irish woman, Savita Halpivanar. And she died 10 years ago in Ireland because she was having a miscarriage and the Irish policy prohibited her from getting an abortion to complete the miscarriage. And she died from sepsis, which is something that I think we will start to see in the US. Her case really mobilized the mass public, especially women in Ireland, to come around this issue. So to your question, yes, policy around the world is really shaped by men because men have the most power all around the world, but women have really been shaping the issue, even when they're not the ones in traditional positions of power.
And I
Which
think
is, it, sorry, Julie, go ahead.
I think it's important to point out that the U.S. is really an outlier internationally right now, that most countries, even countries like Ireland, very Catholic, very long tradition of being very anti-abortion, has loosened its abortion restrictions. Many South American countries, again, heavily Catholic, have been loosening some of their abortion restrictions, that the U.S. is one of the few countries that's going in the opposite direction right now.
I just wanted to point out that the opinion, and now we are, there's a lot of confusion, what's going to happen with the exceptions, the life of the mother in danger, incest or rape. You know, I think, you know, it seems like when states that are going to ban abortion, incest or rape victims are going to have the baby. But at least in terms of this opinion, because they are saying, you know, if there is this rational basis test, if there's a legitimate state interest. So I think in terms of when it's the life of the mother at issue, then the abortion will be allowed. But these are all other issues that are still in play, you know, along with like the medication and all of that. What's going to happen in these circumstances? We don't know yet.
And I think it's just so important. I just have to add there that sure. When we talk about what the life and the health of the pregnant person is, what does that really mean logistically and practically? So just over the weekend, I saw a TikTok from an RN who was talking about a nurse in a trigger state had an ectopic pregnancy come in at 11:30 at night. And an ectopic pregnancy, there's only two outcomes that can happen. Either the fetus dies or both the pregnant person and the fetus dies. There's really no other alternative. And in the trigger state, the doctor actually ended up spending over 9 hours trying to work with lawyers in order to get permission to provide the abortion without losing their medical license. By the time she got it, her abdomen was full of 600 cc's of blood. This is what we're going to start seeing, is that even though technically a lot of these exceptions, though not all of them, say the health or the life of the mother, what does that mean? Does that mean that people have to wait until they are quite literally at death's doorstep in order to get an abortion?
And we've already seen this in Texas, where abortion has been all but illegal since last September, that doctors are reluctant to prescribe treatment for, you know, in medical emergencies, because they don't know if they could end up getting sued.
And Julie, I want to go back to your point real quickly. You mentioned how the U.S. is an outlier. Boris Johnson from Britain, Prime Minister, said in reaction, "I've got to tell you, I think it's a big step backwards. I've always believed in a woman's right to choose, and I stick to that view," end quote. Emmanuel Macron of France, who would never be confused as a political philosopher along the lines of Boris Johnson, said, quote, "Abortion is a fundamental right for all women. It must be protected," end quote. And then Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau called the decision, quote, "horrific," end quote. So we definitely are seeing a lot of international disappointment and dismay over this. We have, as y'all just outlined, so many tentacles that come from this decision. We're going to get into some of those when we come right back. Stay with us. Much more ahead, straight ahead on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and we're continuing our conversation about Roe v. Wade being overturned and some of the many ways it is likely to affect life here in North and South Carolina. Our panel of experts includes Julie Rovner. She is with Kaiser Health News, Seema Iyer from Queen City News, and UNC Chapel Hill Associate Professor Rebecca Kreitzer. Julie, I want to ask you, you know, a lot of us are talking about this decision as sort of abortion allowed, abortion prohibited. How much variance is there from state to state of what's been passed so far, including the fact that we have a law from 1849 taking effect in Wisconsin?
Yes, obviously, there's going to be a huge amount of variation. There will be different, even in states that have the same, you know, written exceptions, there'll be differences in how those are interpreted. As I mentioned, we're already seeing other types of medical care being affected. It'll be affected in several ways. Even if you don't ever get pregnant and have an abortion, it may be more more difficult to find medical care in states that are suddenly, you know, flooded by women seeking abortions from states that ban it. Doctors being resistant to prescribe certain medications or to do anything that could be interpreted as aiding and abetting an abortion, because in several of these states, you've got people who can sue, you know, who can file civil lawsuits against Uber drivers who, you know, take women to clinics or to the pharmacy. I mean, it's going to be, you know, an enormous free-for-all. We're also going to see lawsuits in many of these states about what state constitutions do and don't guarantee. And we're already seeing that changing. In Iowa in 2018, the state Supreme Court said that the Iowa state constitution included right to abortion. And just last week, I believe, a newly configured Iowa Supreme Court said, nope, it doesn't.
And Seema, I see you. You're nodding your head. You are raring to go.
Because I love listening to Julie. I mean, she's just I love it. Yeah.
And what I was going to ask you though, Seema, is you alluded to this earlier. There, you know, in a way, the court, the majority opinion, the 5-4, almost it felt like, okay, well, this is you know, now in the hands of the states, and I think that. What you and others are saying is, oh, no. This is only the beginning of a new chapter. This is nowhere near the end.
Well, you know what Julie said about, you know, the different states, it made me think about the Commerce Clause. Like, are now people going, and not to be like super nerdy wonky right now, but are people now going to make these arguments? Like, let's say I take a Greyhound bus from South Carolina to North Carolina to get an abortion. Is someone going to prosecute Greyhound Bus? I mean, do they have the protection of the Commerce Clause? Is that part of the Commerce Clause? I don't know the answers to all of these things, but I know that the amount of litigation is just going to be, you know, astronomical. But I also do want to point out that Kavanaugh, again, you know, you have these, everybody seems to be in their own corner, but Kavanaugh wrote his concurring opinion seemingly to point out that travel is protected. So you can still travel and get an abortion.
Rebecca?
I would just add that that Attorney General Merrick Garland announced over the weekend some clarifications to this. And so as Seema was saying, many people are wondering about interstate travel. So that's a phrase that comes from the Constitution. And it basically says that the federal government, you know, that interstate travel is allowed and states can't prohibit people going to other states in that way. And so Merrick Garland actually clarified over the weekend to say that there is a right to cross state lines. But I agree with Seema, there's going to be a lot of challenges to that. And we've even seen, even outside of the issue of abortion, state legislatures trying to regulate people leaving the state in order to get trans-affirming healthcare across state lines. So while I think that there is a right to interstate travel, you know, through the Constitution and our history, I agree that there's going to be a lot of challenges to this.
And as I mentioned, also there's in several states now this chance to file civil suits. So even if a woman can travel to another state, get an abortion, come back, that doesn't mean that somebody can't use one of these laws to try and sue that woman sue anyone who helped her for going across state lines.
Along those lines, Rebecca, I want to ask you, North Carolina House Speaker Tim Moore said after the ruling that abortion policy will be a priority in the next session that begins in January. That's a long session. One of the things that we know Republican leaders want to put or to reinstate is the 20-week abortion ban. How much does all of this hinge on November? That's the first half of my question. The second half is, what do you think Speaker Moore and the Republican majority would be looking at if they have the votes in place to do what they'd like to do?
Well, I think that it's very telling that they are saying, well, there's a few days left in the current session, but we have some fiscal matters to take care of, so we'll take it up in the next session. And I think it's because they know that if they brought it up right now, Governor Cooper would veto it. And maybe that would look bad for them if an abortion policy was vetoed and they weren't able to put it into place. Now, I do believe that if they are, and so your first question was like, to what degree does this hinge on the election in November? And I would say to a high degree, it hinges on what happens in November. If the Republicans are able to get a veto-proof majority in the NCGA, I think they will try to put into place the most restrictive ban that they can. And this U.S. Supreme Court has said, you can put in an extraordinarily restrictive ban. In fact, you can just ban it. And I think that because the composition of the Supreme Court has changed, many Republicans are abandoning this strategic incrementalism and will try to put into place their most preferred policy. Now, I have to be clear here and say, it's not necessarily the most preferred policy by most Americans, and not even necessarily the most preferred policy by most Republicans, but it is the most preferred policy by the interest groups that are very influential in supporting the Republican Party.
Julie, you're nodding your head. Did you want to add something to that?
Yes, absolutely. That, you know, we've seen over these last few years, and I can't remember whether Rebecca or Seema mentioned this, that, you know, there was this effort to make incremental changes because that was all they could do. Well, now they can do pretty much anything they want. We'll see what the public opinion backlash looks like, because we do know, you know, as much as public opinion shifts in the middle on abortion, it has not shifted very much on the end. There are small minorities that think abortion should be available, you know, at any point in pregnancy for any reason, and should be unavailable from the moment of conception. Almost everybody else is in that sort of mushy middle. And I think that's what this is going to be the fight for.
But, you know, before this decision, I believe that the last poll I saw said 60 plus Americans thought abortion should not be overturned. So that's why I don't know if it's that Republicans just want to stick together, or they don't want to piss off their base, that everyone is now on this ban abortion train. Because I think there were plenty of moderate Republicans who believed in the right to seek an abortion.
Well, of course, abortion was traditionally a Republican. I mean, there were more Republicans in favor of abortion rights than Democrats.
Right, that's right.
There's been a switch over the last several decades.
Julie, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was just about to ask, and this is something I was ignorant of, shame on me, but I was reading over the weekend, in terms of popular opinion about abortion, that it used to be much more based on education levels and income levels, and then it obviously more recently has become much more a partisan issue. Anything that you attribute that to?
Well, yeah, there were efforts in the early 1970s, just prior to Roe v. Wade. You know, there was famous Richard Nixon, you know, went after suddenly in an effort to get sort of Catholic Rust Belt states, and the South that was starting to turn Republican came out against abortion. That was really the beginning of the Republican Party in general becoming an anti-abortion party. Ronald Reagan, when he was governor, signed a law allowing abortion in California. This was the Republicans were late to this. So, and Democrats, there were so many, you know, Catholic Democrats in the Northeast who were against abortion, many more Republicans who were for abortion rights. I mean, there has literally been a 180 in both parties on this.
Rebecca.
I'd love to chime in on this. So first, let me just say that public opinion on the issue of abortion is murky. It's even murkier than other policy issues. And so just as a professor who studies public opinion, let me just say that the polling we see on abortion is very contingent on things like the phrasing of the question. And they often ask questions like, are you pro-life or pro-choice? But people have different understandings of what those words mean. And even when you say things like, should Roe be upheld or overturned, people don't really understand what that means. And so how people answer is often more expressive of their like kind of general feelings about it, and not what they literally mean on those policy issues, especially when it comes to abortion, because people have extremely complicated and nuanced thoughts about abortion. I agree with, you know, Julie's history, and I would just add in a little bit to that, which is to say that it wasn't until the 1980s that we saw the two political parties establish in their party platforms distinctive issues on the perspectives on the issue of abortion. In fact, the Republican Party platform used to have in it a protection of abortion rights. What we've seen is since then, especially since the 1980s, that there has been a sorting on the issue of abortion, and that the mass public has really adopted their views about abortion from some elites in the party. So by that, I mean, is that we saw that the elites, that's party activists, party leaders, first started to polarize on the issue of abortion. And then the mass public kind of started to follow along with what the party leaders were saying. And one final thing that I'll add is that this polarization and change in how people think about abortion is a very substantial change, and it's bleeding over to other issues. So if we look at something like contraception, Title 10 is the only federal program that that provides affordable family planning, passed very bipartisan in Congress, signed into law by Richard Nixon. But since about the 2000s, now contraception is similarly seen in a very partisan light. The last thing that I'll say about public opinion, and actually I have so many interesting things to say, but I'll limit myself here, which is to say that it used to be that public opinion on the issue of abortion was really shaped by things like you said, Eric, things like education, age. And today it's really shaped by partisanship. But there are some interesting demographic trends. Well, one is that the most liberal people on the issue of abortion are older women. That's pretty unusual. There's no other policy issues where older women are the most liberal. And that's because they remember a time of abortion scarcity. We see significant cohort differences, though Gen Z actually is becoming more liberal than millennials and Gen Xers on the issue of abortion. So we see really interesting trends. Traditionally, there hasn't been a big gender gap between men and women. The bigger gap has been partisanship. However, in the polls that have come out just in the last week, there's a gender gap there that hasn't existed in previous polling.
And you mentioned, I think a couple of you mentioned this idea of nuance. It struck me, I don't know if anyone read Maureen Dowd, the columnist in the New York Times yesterday, but she was outlining Clarence Thomas, who of course was nominated by the elder President Bush. The elder President Bush was a well-known supporter of Planned Parenthood. And so you have sort of that irony, because Clarence Thomas, obviously very hardline pro-life or anti-abortion.
The elder President Bush was the sponsor of the Title 10 bill that Richard Nixon signed, the Federal Family Planning Program.
Correct. Perfect. And that's great context. And on top of that, as I'm sure all three of you know, the current president, Joe Biden, was head of the Judiciary Committee in 1991 when Clarence Thomas's raucous hearings were underway. And Joe Biden and everyone else on that committee dismissed what Anita Hill had to say about her allegations of sexual harassment by Clarence Thomas. And now here we are 30 plus years later. So it is not, it's not black and white. There's a lot of gray in this issue. I want to ask you, Julie, you mentioned that, you know, we can't go to a pre-Roe world in some ways because of abortion pills and other things that have happened. What do you expect, if anything, that will look like pre-Roe America?
That will look like pre-Roe America.
Is there anything that will come back?
Well, obviously, you know, this state by state fight, the idea that this is now going to be fought in 50 state capitals rather than in Washington, although it will be fought in Washington also. If the Republicans, you know, regain control of Congress, they will try for federal restrictions, which the Supreme Court has clearly said would be okay. If the Democrats get a larger majority than they have now, large enough to possibly break the filibuster, they may go for a codification of some right to abortion, if not, you know, what they've been talking about. So I think we're going to see this playing out at every level of government.
Rebecca.
I think to highlight a few similarities and differences. I'll start with some differences. The first thing is that even if we go back to a pre-Roe, you know, world, we're not going to have the same types of illegal abortions that we saw in the 1970s. Namely, illegal abortions in 2022 often are medication abortions, which can be very safe. However, there's been an increase in self-managed abortions, which also can be safe, as long as you're getting non-counterfeit drugs, and we have seen an increase in the black market. We will see, and we are already starting to see, that some of the social movement organizations that existed pre-Roe are once again leading these efforts, namely groups like Abortion Funds, which have been around since pre-Roe, working to raise money and help people travel to obtain abortions. Probably the biggest difference is that we're living now in a digital era. Back in the 1970s and earlier, early 1970s and earlier, when abortion was illegal, we didn't have these digital footprints of everywhere where we've gone. Today, people can safely find access to medication abortion online, but it's very difficult to leave no digital trace. And most Americans are not accustomed to thinking about things in that way.
Seema, I only have a few seconds left, but I want to ask you, give me one issue that you'll be watching closest here in the near future, next 3 to 6 months.
Lawsuits regarding the exceptions. And I just want to say, because just the one last thing is, do not think this doesn't affect you people. Like out there, people who are thinking that if you're not a woman, whatever, everybody's healthcare is going to be affected, because if you're in a state that allows abortion, then you're going to see an influx of people coming in. You may not get your doctor's appointment that you're looking for. There are so many issues that are going to suffer because of this. We're in a constitutional calamity. Have a good day.
That is a great last word. Seema Iyer, Julie Rovner, Rebecca Kreischer, thanks so much for the hour. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.